You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's easy to understand in Darwinian terms why people enjoy food, water, sex, warmth, rest, safety, friendship, and love. They all help us to survive and reproduce. But it's more difficult to figure out why some people take pleasure in activities that appear to have little or no evolutionary payoff, like collecting modern art or listening to opera or, on an extreme level, even practicing cannibalism. Paul Bloom, who's a professor of psychology at Yale, uses a scientific lens to examine what we like and why we like it in his latest book, How Pleasure Works. It's published by Norton. Very pleased that it brings him to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Traditionally, hasn't pleasure been viewed as something purely sensory? We eat, drink, and buy things because it makes us feel good. Are you saying that pleasure is something that's much deeper and more meaningful than most of us had imagined?
That's exactly what I'm saying. Common sense and a lot of science in the past has led to the belief that pleasure is very simple. It's very sensory. You taste with your tongue. You admire a face based on what it looks like. It's very sensory, very low-level, very superficial thing. And what I argue in my book and in my research is that pleasure is a lot deeper than we might expect, that when we respond to things, everything from artwork to a pretty face to a glass of wine, we're actually responding on the basis of our deep beliefs about what it is these things are.
So it's not just, this is not something that's hardwired into us. It has to do with our attitudes about the world, what's natural, what's unnatural, what's moral, what's immoral?
Absolutely. I think there are two parts to it. I think the general bias to look deep, this essentialism, is hardwired. It's universal. I find it in my own research, even in young children. But the way it manifests itself, the sort of cultural influences we're swayed by, the sort of beliefs we have, does differ from person to person, society to society. I think pleasure is a great case study of how genes and innate structure interact with culture and society.
So we see people with different attitudes towards sex, or some people become vegetarians, others want to eat a lot of meat. To what degree do the pleasure that people get from objects or experiences depend on their own cultural background? For example, eating insects would be acceptable and desirable in some cultures, but not others.
Right. So food's a great case study, where there's universals of food and what people like. Babies like sweet breast milk. No baby was ever born liking horseradish. But cultures vary into what foods people enjoy.
That's because they didn't eat roast beef at that age.
That's right. If only they ate brisket, they'd be fine. But cultures differ. They differ in the foods they like. They differ in what they find disgusting. So certain foods like rat or insects that most Americans would find disgusting are just fine for other cultures. And I think that this is a nice example of how what you believe about something affects how you taste it. You know, imagine having a bite of something, enjoying it very much, and then realizing that it was rat or maybe horse or human. It would make a big difference to you.
Has much work been put into the study of pleasure by the psychology community before now?
There's been a huge amount of research. A lot of the research, I think, is tainted by the belief that pleasure has to be superficial and low level. So there's been so much research, for instance, looking at what we find attractive in a face. And people who study this narrow down on the physical features of a face, the symmetry, the ratios of the eyes, the nose, and the mouth. And all of these do play a role. But I think what scientists tend to miss, up until a little while ago, is the fact that you're profoundly influenced when looking at a face and what you think of the person. If it's somebody you like, the face will look much better.
And you suggest also that we're more attracted to people who we're more familiar with.
That's right. So habituation plays a huge role, that the more you know something, the more you enjoy it. Now, it gets complicated because there's a point where boredom kicks in. So if you think about songs, the more you hear a song, the more you like it, up until a point where you've heard it one too many times, and it just drives you crazy.
What about pleasure seekers, sensualists and hedonists? Where do they come into this equation? Don't we sometimes consider them a bit sick?
Well, we not only have ideas about pleasure and system for getting pleasure from things, we also have ideologies and belief about pleasure. So a lot of people think that too much pleasure is a bad thing. A lot of people, including me, would distinguish between pleasure and happiness. So I study pleasure, but I'm not really a hedonist. I think that there's more to life than pleasure. Sometimes a good life is spent dismissing certain pleasures in pursuit of larger goals. pleasure is important, but it's not everything.
You've looked at and helped conduct a number of scientific studies related to pleasure, many of which, or some of which we'll get to during this conversation. Haven't you concluded that when people feel pleasure from something, it usually stems from a deeply held belief or assumption about it, which you've called the object's essence? It sounds like something from Plato. What do you mean by essence?
It is from Plato. I mean, the philosophers like Plato argue that things in the world have essences, invisible properties that make them what they are.
And most philosophy has rejected that notion since.
Most philosophy has rejected that notion. And for instance, evolutionary biologists point out that animals occupy a continuum in biological space. There's no essence of cat that distinguishes it inherently from essence of dog. But at the same time, what I think we could take away from these philosophers is an interesting claim about the human mind, which is that we're common sense essentialists. In fact, this is how I got into this research. I study word learning and category learning in children. And I've found a lot of evidence that children are essentialists. They think things have deeper essences. What's interesting in the domain of pleasure is your belief about those essences can affect the pleasure you take in an object or in a person.
But so is our ability to understand the essence of things what allows us to perceive that a brick that has been painted gold is still just a brick and that a tiger that's been altered to look like a lion is still a tiger?
Absolutely. And there's some lovely developmental research showing that if you make the study simple enough, even two-year-olds understand this. Two-year-olds know that if you put a rat and you put it in a skunk suit so that it looks exactly like a skunk, they'll crack up. They know it's not really a skunk. They know it's really another animal. Two-year-olds have some essentialist belief that there's more to things than what they appear to be.
You describe an experiment you conducted with your colleague Bruce Hood in which you ask young children if you could put the object they prize most, a special stuffed animal or a blanket, into a new 3D duplicating machine that you told them you'd invented and that you'd make an exact copy from. How did they react?
That's right. Bruce is an amateur magician, so we created a duplicating machine. We were interested in whether children really are attached to their teddy bears and security blankets. The results were pretty striking. If you put a regular object into the machine, like their shoe, they're perfectly happy to take home the duplicate. But if you put their teddy bear in the machine, first thing, a good proportion of kids wouldn't let us put their teddy bear into the machine. They just panicked. But among those that let us do it, they wanted the original back. And this suggests that parents are right when they tell you stories about how children refuse to give away, even for washing, their prized objects and how they'll never accept a perfect duplicate.
They understood that the original had an essence that couldn't be transferred.
That's right. And we see this in adults, too. So everybody I know, just about everybody I know, has something in their lives, like their wedding ring or their child's baby shoes, that's literally irreplaceable in that it gets its value from its history. If it was lost, you couldn't get another one because the one that mattered not because of what it looked like or felt like, but because of its unique history.
Does our idea of essence cause us to hang on to our baby's first shoes and other things that we no longer need?
It does. It causes objects to get value solely by dint of their invisible history. So one example is baby shoes or wedding rings. Another example is celebrity objects. So I did some experiments with my colleague George Newman and Gil Diesendruck, where we asked people how much they would pay for, say, George Clooney's sweater. And the answer is they'll pay a lot, so long as it was worn by George Clooney.
And it hadn't been sterilized.
Exactly. So if you tell them, well, how much would you pay for it if it gets thoroughly washed before it gets to you? Then the value drops substantially by about a third. They want it with his essence on it. And their belief about a person's essence is it can be destroyed through cleaning.
On the other hand, they were unhappy when they were asked to try a sweater on that they told had been belonged to Adolf Hitler.
That's right. There's some lovely work by Paul Rosin suggests that this effect of contamination goes both ways. So because I'm interested in pleasure, I'm looking at the positive values it can get. But you're exactly right that you can get negative values, too. Very few people would want to put on Jeffrey Dahmer's sweatshirt.
On the other hand, people do collect Nazi memorabilia.
They do. And in fact, the psychologies of people who collect these Nazi memorabilia and other such items is fascinating. They're a little bit unusual, and we have some evidence that they collect it not so much because they enjoy it themselves, I guess unless they're Nazis, but because they want to talk about it, and it gives them status, and they want to resell it.
My guest is Paul Bloom. His book, How Pleasure Works, The New Science of Why We Like What We Like. It's published by Norton. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Paul Bloom, who's a professor of psychology at Yale University. He obviously has some kind of a philosophical bent, because his previous book was called Descartes' Baby, and now he's written How Pleasure Works, The New Science of Why We Like What We Like. It's published by Norton. On a more extreme level, you write about cannibalism. I remember reading about people in New Guinea and perhaps elsewhere that believe that the powers of the people they defeated, killed, and eaten would be transferred to them. And you write about a more modern case. How does this involve essence?
Yeah, cannibalism is an interesting case study for a couple of reasons. One reason is most of us are so repelled by it. And this is a nice illustration of how our beliefs about the origin of food, like the origin of some meat in front of us, could affect how we react to it. Nobody would want to eat human flesh, even if you were convinced that it tastes like chicken or pork or whatever. I think there's another connection, though, which is a lot of cannibalism is connected to the belief that people have essences, and then by consuming them, you can incorporate some of their essences. So many cultures that celebrate cannibalism do so out of an explicit belief that you could imbue the essence of your loved ones and keep them alive. Modern-day cannibals like Jeffrey Dahmer would often talk this way, talk about the desire to keep people alive inside them, to capture what makes them special and individual people. It's definitely perverse and immoral and unusual, but I think it captures some biases that all of us possess.
Are we trying to capture somebody else's essence when we pay $50,000 for a tape measure that had belonged to JFK, or the person who offered $10 million for the shoes that were thrown at George W. Bush by an Iraqi journalist in 2008?
I think so. I think that there are all sorts of reasons why an object's history might matter. It might be connected to a historical event. It might be sort of specially personally relevant. But one big reason why objects get their value is because they have a physical connection with beloved and adored people. One example of this are the relics of saints. Certain religious objects are said to be close to Jesus or close to saints or even close to God and get their value. And a modern-day equivalent is people paying for something that was worn by George Clooney or Cameron Diaz or something like that.
We talked to people who conducted an experiment that you cite, in which people were asked to sip wine through a tube while they underwent a brain scan. And as they drank, they were given information about the wine and its cost. You want to remind us what the brain scan showed?
I love that study. It had people lying in an fMRI scanner while they're sipping wine through a tube. And as they're sipping the wine, they get information about how much it costs. And of course, everybody's sipping the same wine. They just get different information. So what these investigators find is, if you're drinking the cheap stuff, if you drink, you like it less than the expensive stuff. But what's even more cool is that when you're drinking the expensive stuff, parts of the brain that are associated with reward and pleasure light up like a Christmas tree. And this is worth knowing, because one critical response to a lot of this research is that people don't really enjoy these things more. They just are saying, they're trying to show off, they're trying not to admit that they don't appreciate something. But these studies, and many studies like it, suggest it's a lot deeper than that. It suggests that the wine really does taste better at a very visceral level when you believe it's expensive.
So if you drink a moderate costing wine and are told that it's released at $300 a bottle, you're going to think it's better than the $300 a bottle of wine that you were told was released for $10?
We're influenced by all sorts of factors, and it could be that there's something in the real $300 bottle of wine that really is so much better that it overrides things. But for most of us, yes. If you want to impress your guests and give them wine that they really enjoy, don't buy the expensive stuff. Tell them they're drinking the expensive stuff.
Well, so it's really important to just think that something is worth a lot, and that gives you more pleasure. Therapists say they charge what they do because people value their services more if they cost more.
That's right. That's right. If the therapist gave it away for free, people would think it has no value. And of course, you know, in the marketing world, there's all sorts of cases where you want to raise the price of something so that people think it's really valuable.
Well, for example, Joshua Bell got involved in an experiment, the great violinist. He was playing on a train platform instead of a concert hall, and he only made $32.
It's a wonderful story. It was an experiment done by this Washington Post reporter, Gene Weingarten. And you know, the question is, how much would you like the sound of Joshua Bell if you didn't know it was Joshua Bell? And so Bell very graciously agreed to go down, and he played his music. You could watch this on YouTube. And people just walk by. They don't listen. Some of them stop to listen, but you don't appreciate it. It doesn't sound as good if you don't know who it is.
What about authenticity? If we know something is a forgery, it obviously we value it less, even if it's great.
I mean, that's the most striking example of how origin counts. I begin my book with the story of a famous forgery, which was thought to be by a Vermeer and turns out to be by a Dutch forger.
Hans van Meegeren.
And the value, once it was found out, dropped to nothing. It was this horrible event for the Dutch people. It was a horrible event for Hermann Goering, who was the Nazi who bought the painting from him. And it's almost comical what a difference it makes, how much it matters whether the very same physical object is created by, you know, a great master, or whether it's a forgery. You know, I should add, I don't think there's anything wrong with this. I think it's a hugely rich and valuable and uniquely human way to get pleasure from things. But it does open us up to get fooled.
But people do get pleasure from art that they know was not made by a famous artist.
Absolutely. And we get pleasure from objects that have no history. We get pleasure from wine we don't know the price of. I wouldn't deny for a second that sensory experiences and all sorts of other experiences can sway our pleasure. But what I would maintain is that every pleasure there is, from looking at a great painting to something very physical like, you know, filling your belly or having an orgasm, is always colored and transformed by your belief about what it is you're experiencing.
Do we tend to value an object that we've made ourselves over objects that were made by others or purchased in a store?
Yes.
What psychologist Michael Norton calls the IKEA effect?
Yes, so there's many of these economic examples of how, even in basic day-to-day transactions, we are subject to these beliefs that are swayed by the origin of something. So yes, the IKEA effect is, if you put it together yourself, you'll like it more. It's more valuable.
Even though IKEA does mean to many people cheap.
Yes, so then there's other factors, which is, you know, one would imagine a useful marketing idea would be a very high-status company that still had you put makes you put some of the things together by yourself. Presumably, commercial cake mixes, when they first came out, Michael Norton tells the story, nobody wanted to buy them, and then they figured out that the person making the cake had to do something, like crack an egg into it or do something like that. Otherwise, it wouldn't have any value.
This also leads to the dismissal of a lot of modern art by, well, my kid could do that, and of course, your kid could never do a Jackson Pollock.
Right. In fact, you know, it's hard to find issues in pleasure that are more controversial than what to make of modern art. And, you know, I think these are complicated questions, but one question that you put your finger on, which is when you look at something and you appreciate it, this appreciation involves an understanding of the performance going into it. So if you really think my kid could do that, you look at a Jackson Pollock and think, it's some guy splashing paint on the wall, my kid could do that, chimp could do that, you're not going to like it very much. On the other hand, if you believe this artwork and other artworks like it are due to training and experience and hard work, you'll get more pleasure from it.
But we also get a lot of pleasure from all of those stories about how an elephant painted a painting that some art critic thought was a work of genius.
Yes, I mean, there are other pleasures, and you know, one particular pleasure is watching an expert make a fool of himself.
Darwin described the love of singing or music as one of the most mysterious features of humans. Isn't music a uniquely human pleasure, despite that old thing about soothing the beast?
Music is a uniquely human pleasure. It is universal, and it is a mystery. You know, I'm very interested in how your beliefs about music can affect your experience of it. But the question of why we like music in the first place is we know no more about it than when Darwin speculated about it. It is honestly a mystery about human nature, why music gives us so much pleasure.
And then dance grows out of music, doesn't it?
Music and dance are intimately connected through almost all cultures. So in modern Western culture, we have this odd thing where we're just listening to music sitting still in our room. And you have to realize how unusual that is. The natural state of people, this much we know from Darwin and this much we know from anthropological studies, the natural state is to connect music and dance deeply. You sing, you dance, There's no such thing as an expert singing and everybody else just sits quiet and observes. So this is an interesting fact about music that might tell us something about its origin, the fact it's connected to dance.
I'm curious about what is hardwired in us for pleasure and what is not. Obviously, even the things that can give us the most pleasure are not always taken advantage of by everyone. People can eat really very simple foods. Some people don't have sex. Some people actually prefer to live in dangerous situations, while others want really comfortable situations. So is how much of this is part of our genetic makeup, and how much of this is stuff that we learn through all sorts of other experiences?
I think there's at least two things going on. One is the extent to which you actively pursue pleasure in your life, to what extent you choose to have sex and get drunk and eat fine foods and so on. And people differ in that, and I think that's the standard combination of genetic differences and temperament and so on, as well as culture. A second consideration is the pleasures themselves. So for whatever reason, people differ in all sorts of interesting ways in the sort of pleasures they enjoy. Some people like spicy foods, others don't, and go on for 100 other examples. And I tend to be interested in the universals and what aspects of pleasure all human beings share. But the differences are fascinating, and we confront them in day-to-day life with family members and friends who have these mysterious pleasures to us because we could never enjoy them.
Paul Bloom is a professor of psychology at Yale University. His latest book, How Pleasure Works, The New Science of Why We Like What We Like. It is published by Norton. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me on. Thank you.